Hi, this is Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and you're listening to my friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show, and we just have so much fun, my baby love, me and Mike Miller. Woo!
Hi, this is Terry Stewart, CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on one of my favorite shows, the Harmony Street Show.
Hey, Mike, John Mathis.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. It's Johnny Mathis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Hey, this is Mike Miller from the Harmony Street Show. You know, every once in a while you think back over your musical years and the groups that were your favorite groups, and there's one that stands out in my mind over a lot of the other groups, and that group is Three Dog Night. Most people don't realize it, but this group had over 21 consecutive Billboard Top 40 hits. They had 13 gold albums. Three Dog Night was one of the most popular rock bands in the world. It was Chuck Negron guiding the group through 18 consecutive Top 20 hits. But listen, while Three Dog Night was hitting those high notes and having all that commercial success, Chuck Negron was sinking into the darkness of drug addiction. After the band's 13th album failed to go gold in 1975, the band called it quits. Chuck was supporting a $2,000 a day drug habit. Chuck Negron was unquestionably the unmistakable lead voice of Three Dog Night. As a matter of fact, Rod Stewart, Aerosmith, Electric Light Orchestra, Uriah Heep, and Led Zeppelin were opening acts for Three Dog Night. Chuck's story is a fabulous story, how he fought his way back from drug addiction to get back up on the shelf and bring us those wonderful vocals. Chuck details his demise and his long road back in his book, Three Dog Nightmare. But one thing is for sure, Chuck is back better than ever, giving us those fabulous vocal tones that we remember so well from Three Dog Night. Hey, Chuck, let me just say, we're awfully glad that you're back. God bless you, Chuck. Thanks, man.
Leave me outside of my injury. Just an old-fashioned love song playing on the radio. And wrapped around the music is the sound of someone promising they'll never go. You swear you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on.
An old-fashioned love song, one I'm sure they wrote for you and me. Just an old-fashioned love song, coming down in three-part harmony.
To weave our dreams upon and listen to each evening when the lights are low. To underscore our love affair with tenderness and feeling that we've come to know. You say you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on and on. No need in bringing them back because they're never really gone.
Just an old-fashioned love song, coming down in three-part harmony. Just an old-fashioned love song, you and me. Just an old-fashioned love song, coming down in three-part harmony. Just an old-fashioned love song, one I'm sure they wrote for you and me.
Dream our dreams upon and listen to a song.
My whole life is about you.
Yes, it is.
wrong. You're not the first to last who's lost everything. And you can't bundle up your feelings.
This is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and I am thrilled to have as my guest rock and roll royalty, the original founding member and lead singer of Three Dog Night, Mr. Chuck Negron. How you doing, Chuck?
Oh, I'm great, man. Nice to be speaking with you.
Same, same. Well, you know, we met many years ago at a Three Dog Night concert. I had a friend, Fran, that followed my Harmony Street group. I had a group with three ladies, myself as a lead singer and a bass singer, all doo-wop, of course, very Manhattan transfer-ish. And Fran, she went under the name of Fran Green and then sometimes Fran Vecina. I don't know if you remember her.
Yeah, sure. That name is very familiar. I do recall her.
Yeah. You were born and raised in the Bronx.
Yeah, born in Manhattan and then raised in the Bronx. Loved it there. It was a great time there. Not far from the Yankee Stadium. You know, when the guys were in the series, you could hear that place roar. You know, and it was a wonderful time. We also had the Dodgers and the Giants.
Right, right. Well, I was a Parkchester kid, believe it or not, and I used to walk home from PS 106, and we had the Purdy Street Gang. And then the Fornaboldies used to come over and beat up the Purdy Street Gang, you know, when they used to come over to my area. So, you know, that was retribution.
Yeah, the Baldies were not far from where I lived.
Yeah, Dion claims to be a Baldy. I don't really know.
Maybe he is now.
yeah, well, you know, no, Dion lives down the block from me in Boca. I told him he's getting to look like a little old Jewish man. you know what I said to him? I said that all men, no matter what ethnicity they are, when they reach 90, they start shrinking and speaking Yiddish.
Well, we definitely start shrinking, that's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, and as a matter of fact, Shari Lewis babysat for my brother and I, and her mother was Mrs. Horowitz, the music teacher at PS 106, believe it or not.
Yeah. That's great.
I'm going to go you even one better, but we'll get to that in a little bit. You know, your vocal prowess and the things that you've done, did you have music in your family growing up?
No, I mean, not really. Not my mother. My father sang.
Right.
And he made some records. So we did. He was a singer and, you know, did weddings and did, you know, stuff trying to get his break.
Right. Very cool. And really and truly, I think a lot of people don't know that, as some other people that we know that went on to do pop and rock and roll, you really had your roots in doo-wop. Is that true?
Oh, yes, yes. When I was 15, we put a group together called the Rondells.
Right.
And we played the Apollo when we were 16. You know, did many, many clubs in Brooklyn and Harlem because our managers were black. So they were with acts at sometimes. So we worked around, made several records, and it was a great time. Yeah, it was all doo-wop.
Right. I mean, you know, how was it getting anywhere near the Apollo at that age? I mean, you know, this is something that people all their lives strive for. That must have been a trip.
Oh, it was very, very exciting. And, you know, at first they weren't very excited to see us. five white kids, you know, 15 and 16 in matching green sweaters.
Right.
But you know, we got up there and sang. They rooted us home. So the wonderful lesson that music brings everyone together.
Right. I mean, you know, that's a fantastic story. So, you know, you did the Brill Building, you know, like we all did, and some of us were more successful than others because I hung around and had songs. And I got some great rejections. I remember Joe Kolsky, from Prelude, sending me the nicest rejection letters. You know, he was one of the sweet guys. Most of them didn't send you anything.
That's really nice, He took the time to do that. You know, that was great. But yeah, the Brill Building, 1650, Broadway, we haunted those places trying to get a deal and, you know, get some of our music out there.
Right. Well, you know, when I was younger, I had a cousin. His name is Gary Katz. I think you know Gary. He did the whole Steely Dan thing.
Yeah, I do know Gary.
Of course. And, you know, Gary used to come to functions that we had, and Gary was not a joiner. If we had a buffet or if we had a sit-down dinner, he would go down the block and get a deli sandwich and sit in the corner. But he had this thing, this dream. And, of course, you know, Becker and Fagan grew out of the Janie Merkins thing and Kenny Vance and whatever. And I have another good friend that lives in Boca, Dennis Lambert. They originally took Becker and Fagan to Dennis, and he passed on them. So my cousin Gary, you know, always told me with all my groups that, you know, I had nice vocals, but they were white Jewish vocals.
White Jewish vocals.
White Jewish vocals. He says, come on, man, you got white Jewish vocals. Leave me alone.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, very funny, you know, coming from a guy like Gary. Tell me about your basketball career.
Well, you know, I loved playing ball. And by the time I was in the ninth grade, I was starting to get, you know, how you do in the neighborhood, a reputation. I mean, I didn't know I was good.
Right.
But people were going, oh, that's him, blah, 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 blah. You know, I went into Taft High School. My very first year, I made the varsity, which, you know, was never heard of.
Yeah.
And, you know, went to Madison Square Garden my first year for the high school finals, actually all 3 years.
Wow.
So, you know, so I had a lot of people looking at me, and by the time I was a senior, I was an all-city basketball player, and I was recruited by some great, great schools. So, so I got to go to college for free and have, you know, arguably the nicest fun time in my life. You know, it was wonderful.
Wow. Well, you know, interestingly, I started out at CW Post, but I wound up at LIU. And, of course, we had Luther Green, who went to the Nets and got $50,000, was more money than he ever saw in his whole life. And I think he played, he sat on the bench, he played. But what's interesting is I was a dean in the Bronx. I lived in Connecticut. You know, I escaped. My father moved us out of the Bronx. But I then went to become a dean in the Bronx at Castle Hill Junior High School. And they had these after-school programs. So I said, that'd be nice. I was a first-year teacher. So my father said to me, you know, it's all about politics. So my father's partner, Bernie Ettinger, who played for CCNY and whatever, he says, you know, I have this friend. His name is Norm Drucker. Let me give him a call, he says, and he'll you know, call the powers that be and whatever. And, of course, Norm was one of the ABA refs at that time.
Yeah, I know, you know, because my father-in-law, Ozzy Silner, was the owner of the Spirits of St. Louis in the ABA. He was he was one of the founding guys in the ABA. Anyway, go on.
Right. So Norm Drucker got me the job. He caught all the powers that be. And, you know, they were waiting to get into those jobs, to be born into those jobs. And I was a first-year teacher. One phone call, bing bong. So, I mean, that's really how it works.
a little political persuasion through, you know, if you have the power to do a favor for somebody, you can get a favor for someone else.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, my daughters, who are older than me now, you know, every time I try to make a phone call and do them a favor, they always said to me, I want to do it myself, Dad. And I would say, that's what I get. Here I'm a Jewish guy that you know, did not marry a Jewish girl. I said, you got to get that Yiddish a cup. You know, you got to think like that. You know, always let the person make the phone call for you, you know.
Sure.
Anyway.
Sure. Yeah, but my kids are that way, too.
Yeah.
Dad.
Well,
I can do this. You know.
You know, speaking about kids, and then we're going to get into music.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook. It helps my radio show, and I'm still singing and whatever. But you know, I noticed that I read your Facebook page, and I notice how much you're into your kids and the family. And really and truly, you're one of the few people that reaches out to people a little bit. I mean, a lot of people who have arrived at this level of success, you know, they don't put it out there to reach out to their fans, and you do. And I
think, you know, it's very easy to become guarded. When you do reach out, you inevitably attract someone,
right,
who's going to take a shot, who's going to, you know, do something. Here's a perfect example of how, you know, kind of nasty it can get. I'm 22 years sober.
Right.
I put a picture. It was a beautiful day. I took a shot of myself, and I said, you know, some fun on the deck.
Right.
And I put it up there. Guy goes, Chuck, are you drinking?
Oh, man.
You know, it's like, so every once in a while, I was really involved up until about 6 months ago, and it was a kind of a fight brewed about different stuff that was no one's business.
Right.
And I just, you know, I kind of just went, and I backed off. I still put pictures of my kids and
right.
stuff, you know, but I'm not as involved. And that's why a lot of, you know, my peers don't get involved, because, you know, you're putting yourself out there to be attacked.
No, you're right. And it makes you vulnerable, you know, of course. And, you know, there's every different type out there, you know, big, little, blue, green, left, right, you know, and they all have different mindsets. And basically, you never know what you're going to get. I guess you just have to let it go by, because basically, and I will tell you this because I am a fan as well. Your fans love you. I mean, Three Dog Night was, they were just the epitome of everything, their arrangements, their vocals, and everything else. Let's talk about your arrangements musically and vocally.
Sure.
Who was responsible for putting together, you know, the fabulous harmonies and the arrangements that you guys did?
Well, they came about with Davey Corey and I,
right,
sitting down and just working, you know, working on things. And trying, you know, different harmonies, and you know, next thing you know, we had something, we had something special. What it was a gift a blessing. The three of us just had voices that worked good together, and when we started hitting the harmonies and I started hitting those high things, sometimes even octaves,
right.
An octave above the low note or the tonic,
right.
You know, it just rang, and everyone knew we had something. So it was, you know, it was just a special gift from God. You know, the three of us, the way we sounded when we sang, but we always worked together.
Right.
Except on a few songs we did ourselves. We did all the harmonies. And
right.
Like Pieces of April.
Right.
I did all the harmonies just because they weren't there.
Right.
You know what I mean? If they were there, they would have done. But,
April gave us springtime and the promise of the flowers and the feeling that we both shared and the love that we call ours. We knew no time for sadness. That's a road we each had crossed. We were living a time meant for us. And even when it would rain, we would laugh it all. I've got pieces of April. I keep them in a memory bouquet. I've got pieces of April. It's a morning. Of summer beneath an oak of blossom green, feeling as I did in April, not really knowing what it means, but it must be them that stand beside me now to make me feel this way. Just as I did in April, but it's a morning in me. Pieces of April, I keep in a memory bouquet. I've got pieces of April, but it's a morning in May. I've got pieces of April, I keep in a memory bouquet. I've got pieces of April. It's a morning in May. It's a morning. It's a morning in May. Just a morning. Just a morning. Just a morning. Morning in May.
special thing that we had.
Well, you know, and also the street corner experience didn't hurt because, you know, you get to hear the harmonies and everything else. I was lucky enough to pick up the guitar when I was a kid, you know, and at least, you know, have that point of reference. So every group I was in, I always said, you know, here's the chord, here are the notes, whatever. When somebody was singing that note that you know didn't belong there, I would show them, it's not in the chord, it's this chord. It's like, get rid of it.
Great advantage. Yeah. I played the least. Danny and Corey both played. So, you know, we always sat around the piano or the guitar, and or when we were in the studio, listened to the track, having this keep throwing a track at it. Now, I have to give credit to the band, the four musicians.
Right.
Because once we picked the key and laid out kind of the structure, the arrangement in the form of events.
Right.
They went in there and these guys, man.
Oh, well, yeah.
They were unbelievable. They changed stuff, and we wouldn't have, you know, we just happened to have a great, great band that was a part of the group.
Yeah, you
but
did.
But we were very fortunate. They were very, very creative guys, and, you know, I mean, look how many hit tracks those guys.
Well, I know that. You know, one thing that always made me laugh is when you're on the street corner, you know, if you could sing Gloria, everybody crowded around and says, oh, yeah, they could do that, you know, certain tunes. But I will tell you this. Now, I had a top 40 group, and we used to play, you know, around Long Island or whatever, and we used to do It's For You. And I used to say to my, you know, we did it a cappella, and I would say to myself, you know, that really separated the men from the boys. I would think now, who do you have to be vocally in order to do this? You know, it's like you either sang that song or you didn't. What? No, I can imagine. But, you know, I used to think to myself, it reminded me of what the Maguire sisters must have gone through when they learned Mr. Sandman, because it was all chimes.
Yeah. That was a pretty song, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but, you know, to get out there night after night and to nail that song, you know, in front of people, it's like, it's got to become part of your being.
Yeah. And is there, like, a lot of echo in the room? Recast it. Just could really be trouble. But, I mean, and that didn't happen often, but there were rooms that would just, you know, because back then, you know, you played in everything, barn, you know, you played everywhere.
You know, you're talking about echo. We did, Harmony Street was a good group. We actually were the entertainment for Bill and Hillary at the White House at the 98 Christmas party. We did everything but have a hit, you know, but, you know, as a group that was a doo-wop group all those years later. And, you know, we did Shea Stadium. I called up Johnny Maestro and I said, what's the secret to doing the anthem at the stadium? So we did a 25-minute show a cappella and then the anthem. He says, you can't listen to the, you know, to that echo on the speakers because there's a 1 second delay by the time you sing and by the time it comes out of the speakers. You got to listen to the real time monitor. Otherwise you're dead. And if he didn't tell us that, we would have been dead. You know,
he was just a wonderful singer.
Yeah. Johnny, as a matter of fact, I spoke to him the night before he passed away. He was, John was a little misunderstood. You know, he was very laid back and shy and people thought he was standoffish, but he wasn't. You know, he was just Johnny with a dry sense of humor and a real sharp edge and a real perfectionist. And, I'm sure a Three Dog Night fan because, you know, he loved the rock groups. He loved Aerosmith. So there
go.
Oh yeah, you know, I think he was a rocker at heart. you know.
Yeah, we did a show together and I walked over to him.
Oh cool, man.
To meet him and he was just thought it was so special that I would come over to him.
Oh sure.
You know, and I talked to him about a show and he remembered my girlfriend, one of the Rondells and I would go down to the Alan Freed show.
Wow.
And, you know, we both dressed pretty cool and we looked pretty good and our girlfriend was very hot.
Right.
So we got in. Uh-huh. We got in and we danced. We actually became, part of the people who danced. But anyway, one day, the Crests are on.
Wow.
So, and they have them on this little, they have Johnny on one circle, and then a higher circle of wood, they had the rest of the band.
Right.
And when they were doing their steps, one of the guys stepped right off and fell.
Oh, no.
So I said, do you remember when one of you guys, he went, oh, my God. I said, I was at that TV show.
Wow. Well, you know, J.T. Carter is still around. He was the bass. I got to ask him that story. I got to say, hey, man, remember when somebody fell off the riser at the Paramount Theater at the Alan Freed show?
No, actually, it was the TV show.
Oh, it was the TV show.
It was the TV show. So I asked him.
Wow, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey there, this is J.T. Carter, the original founding member of the Crest, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
So let's get back to... Three Dog Night. What was the first hit, Chuck?
The first hit was Try a Little Tenderness, which went to 19.
Right.
She may be weary. Young girls, they do get weary. Wearing that same old funky dress. But ooh, why she gets weary, weary. Won't you try some tenderness? You know she's there waiting and anticipating for the things she'll never know. Won't you try, oh, try some tenderness? Mm-hmm. And I know it.
that became one, and that became, went to number one and became a million sellers. So that really broke it open for us. And, you know, there's nothing better than, you know, that early in your career getting a gold record.
Oh, man.
Selling a million records.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
I think it went to number three on the Billboard chart.
Especially people
I'm hung up on you. Easy to be proud, easy to say no.
We're
in the top 20 at the same time.
Wow.
So, you know, so we were really cooking then.
I'm telling you. And you know, what a feeling. Now, here's my question. When you recorded one, and I don't know how many takes it took, you know, because I usually ask, how many takes? Some groups say, oh, we did it in one take. Some say, well, after the 40th take, you know, we went back and took take number three, you know. Yeah. Did you know what you had when you walked out of the studio that day?
Yeah. When I went in to the booth, when I went into the booth,
right,
they said, "Look, well, let's put a record, mention this. You got to hear this."
Right,
and you know, I heard the vocal and the track, and I knew we had a hit song.
Wow!
I actually turned around to the guys and I said, "We have a hit."
Wow.
And, you know, and so at any rate, it was just awesome. I do not know how many takes it took to sing that. I do not remember. But I do remember Easy to Be Hard was one take.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I did it once, and the producer said, "You're done."
That's a good feeling.
Done. I'm just getting started.
Right.
You know, so anyway.
I'm just warming up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I hear you. But then, you know, and then you think back. And, you know, during the week, I'm thinking, well, Chuck Negron's going to call me. And here I have Chuck Negron, you know, what am I going to ask him and everything? And I started to think about all of the songs in my mind. And I, you know, it's like every time I thought of, you know, the stuff that you guys produce, I kept adding songs in my mind. And I said, my God, the list is endless of all the hits. I mean, you know, when you really think about it, It just goes on and on and on. I mean, it seemed like it lasted forever, hit after hit after hit.
Yeah, 21 top 40 songs.
Unbelievable. And really and truly, for people that don't know, Three Dog Night sold more records than any other group. And Three Dog Night had the big groups opening up for them. And, you know, it doesn't get better than that.
So, yeah, it was an amazing... It was an amazing time because we were not just selling records. We were the first band that ever did nothing but ballparks. I mean, we were the first bands to walk into these ballparks, and, you know, and you don't even realize until you get there, you know, they don't want you there. You know, because they don't want their field ruined. And they,
right.
You know, you're hippies and, you know, they're just straight guys. And, you know, so it was a real groundbreaking thing. You know, we sold more tickets than anybody, and it was very, very exciting time for us.
Well, you know, let's put it this way. You know, when you get to be on Bill O'Reilly's show, it means you made it to the top. Which is great, you know.
He's done quite good for himself.
He's a trip.
He's a trip.
We'll leave it at that.
Thanks for staying with us. I'm Bill O'Reilly, and in the personal story segment tonight, kicking the drug habit. We hear many pundits screaming for tax money to fund drug rehabilitation, but some believe, and I am in this category, that most drug rehab simply doesn't work. Joining us now is the former lead singer for the rock group Three Dog Night, Chuck Negron, who was addicted to hard drugs for 25 years and who has written a book called Three Dog Nightmare. Mr. Negron also has a new CD out called The Long Road Back. Now, you were in 36 rehab centers?
Yes.
36?
36. They treated me like a celebrity. They let me do what I want, go on passes when I wanted to, and it was really absurd.
It didn't work?
No.
Flat out?
No.
What works?
I went to a long-term rehab. They kept me. I was there almost a year. It took me at least 6 months to return to sanity, physically come up to par, weighed 126 pounds. So just to get separated from the drama of drug life, the actual physical addiction and the mental obsession. It took at least 6 months for that to be relieved. So if I had left any time before that, I would have been using drugs again.
So finally you got into a long-term situation where you were off the street, right? You didn't go home.
I couldn't make a phone call for 3.5 months.
What program was this?
CryHelp, the best.
But was there something in your psychological profile that made you want to be intoxicated all the time?
That's a great question. I think I was very shy, very awkward, and it made me feel handsome. It made me talk better.
You didn't have confidence, self-confidence.
No. I was very, very shy in a business that was full of very brazen people.
Right. So it was winked at then. Oh, Chuck's stoned again.
Okay, here's a great example. The commercial airlines would no longer allow me on their flights. We bought a plane. So that's how we addressed this.
Why wouldn't they allow you on a flight?
Oh, I used to take the oxygen, and it all would come down on people's heads.
All right, so I was nuts. You were stoned, and you were misbehaving, Chuck.
That was totally inappropriate.
Right.
I was a jerk.
But that's what rock stars do a lot.
Yeah, and then there's sex in the bathroom, and, you know, just...
Well, I think we're going to have to read your book to get there.
I like him. He's, you know, as arrogant as he is.
I tape it. I mean, I'm going to tape it. It's going to be taped, and I'll watch it later, because I want another perspective that you cannot get on network news.
Absolutely, the spin stops there.
They don't even give you half the news that's going on.
Listen, and that's another whole conversation we could have. We're gonna have that one on another day.
Yeah, and I listen to CNN because that's another view that isn't totally biased.
I got you.
Yes, so I enjoy it. Anyway, it keeps my mind going.
I hear you loud and clear. Three Dog Night had that right up the middle. It had that organ sound, you know. When you got into the R&B, sound of the 70s, you know, had that Fender Rhodes, and Steely Dan had that Fender Rhodes and whatever. But Three Dog Night had that organ sound a lot of times through a Leslie. Other times just, you know, but that sound was always there, and that used to intrigue me all the time.
Yeah, it was my opinion that the B3, organ through the Leslie 900 was, you know, one of the signature sounds of Three Dog Night. So,
right.
And wonderful keyboard player Jimmy Grunstein. He can make that thing just really be nasty, and then also out in the country, the solo that he did in Out in the Country, I mean, it doesn't even sound like a B3. It sounds like, you know, some, you know, kind of wind instrument. It's really nice.
Need to get away. I find
when I played guitar in some of the top 40 groups on Long Island, I used to play guitar through a Leslie, and it was very, very different because, you know, you had to strum differently. I had to strum like half the time because I'd have to let the chord ring and carry on.
Yeah,
but
I
got used to doing that. It was very, very different. And people used to come in and say, "You're playing guitar through a Leslie?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And they'd go, "Man, how do you do that?"
It's crazy time.
Another thing that I read was that Three Dog Night had control over their arrangements and their tunes, not like other groups that pretty much had record companies telling them what to do and how to do it.
Well, we were making our deal. There was some talk about us, and there were several record companies that wanted us. And when ABC Dunhill made an offer, we said we want artistic control. After some, bickering and all that stuff.
Right.
They gave it to us. They gave us because they heard the music that we had done. They knew we had good tunes. They took a leap of faith and it worked out because if it hadn't, the very next negotiation, we would have lost that right. So no, we never had any interference from them, ever.
Right, which is cool. But then I guess when you're popping out hits and, after a while they say, let's leave them alone, I had, believe it or not, and this is just a little aside, I was doing a disco album at Media Sound on 57th Street, John Roberts and Joe Roseman, and Aerosmith was right next to us. And those guys kept popping into where we were recording and just like kidding around with us. And we noticed, after a while that they weren't doing any recording or being productive. They were just hanging out. They kept coming in and saying, "Hey, you guys holding anything? You guys, hey." And I looked at them and I said, "Are you kidding me, man? You guys should be inviting us in, if anything." And what happened was after that, they spent a lot of money just doing nothing and they had to go back out on tour and make back the money and all of that, And I said to myself, it's like they were kind of just wasting time as opposed to other groups that went in and were all business, They did what they had to do.
Yeah, I guess they were going in the right and no one got it started.
Yeah, that can happen, you can get into a rut. Let's talk about actually Chuck a little bit. It's common knowledge that you had a period of time that the drugs pulled you down. Plain and simple. There was even a story that I read about witnessing some kind of a drive-by shooting.
Well, it didn't have a big impact. And the reason, and the story, it's in my book.
Right.
The story is to show the power of addiction and how insane you were. I was on a payphone at this gas station. I called my dealer. I said, "Hey, you got something?" He went, "Hold on 1 second." And I'm on hold. This car drives around the corner, two men straddling the windows, and I see this guy in the gas station, and they start shooting.
Wow.
At him. And the next thing I know is I'm watching them. They're still driving, and the other guy's shooting. Now I'm in the middle.
Right.
I'm in the middle of these two guys, and my dealer went, "Okay, Chuck, where do you want to meet?" And there was no way I was putting on that phone.
Right.
I said, "Well, look, I'll meet you at the bottom."
Right.
One bullet flew off the top of the guy.
I see. Whereas most people would have just, that would have been it for them.
They would have got on the floor.
Yeah.
That's how insane I was.
At any rate.
And I went off and my dealer didn't think twice about it. I wasn't shaking. My mission was to get to score drugs and that's all that was on my mind. And years later I thought, "Oh my God, that was insane. I could have been killed." And I didn't think twice about that possibility.
How long did that period last? And, I guess, You were still singing with Three Dog Night at that point.
When I was at Three Dog Night, I was doing drugs, but it really hadn't brought me down yet, because I was towards the end, just getting involved with heavier drugs. Actually, Joe Shermy, our bass player, was fired because of his drug use, and Danny Hutton was fired because of his alcoholism and drug use. So, it was prevalent in the band.
Right.
And then at the very end, it was just Corey and me at the Greek Theater, and he said, "I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore." And my drug habit was bad.
Gotcha.
So yeah, and that went on for 20 years.
Right. I hear you. I mean, that could be. But then I'm sure even during that time, not being with the group, there were so many people that would recognize you and say, "Here's Chuck Megron right in front of me. You know, how you doing, Chuck?" And, were you able to function at that time? I'm sure you had good days and bad days.
Well, you know, for quite a while, I just stayed in my house. I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And then the time came to turn my life around, and I started seeking people and places that would be conducive to me having another chance, and I was blessed. It worked out, and it was 22 years ago. I have 22 years sober, but it was a very hard journey. It was a very long journey because I was addicted for so long.
Well, look, and I'm not just blowing smoke, and you've heard this probably from many people. In order to make that turnaround, it's pretty tough. A lot of people are not able to make that turnaround. A lot of people don't have the strength to come back and really get on the other side of it. I know Dion very well. He was able to do that, and he preaches, and he's very vehement about the fact that he's been clean and sober all that time.
Oh, come live.
Let's talk about the book a little bit. The correct title of the book is?
The Chuck Negron Story, Three Dog Nightmare.
Three Dog Nightmare, which is, I guess, an appropriate title. I have not read the book. I'm going to read the book. I'm going to buy the book, and you're going to sign it for me.
Oh, that's what's
going to
happen.
So I can put it on the shelf with all of my...
All your books. Okay.
No. All of my books that I hold in reverence.
Okay.
Tell me about CRI Help, Cry Help.
Cry Help is a long-term rehab, which kind of, takes the last people on the block. Now they've become a beautiful new facility, and it's different. But when I went there, they were basically barracks, and they had a contract with the prisons and a contract with the youth authority.
Right.
And then there were people right off the streets, so and as well as people like myself. Sly Stone went there about a year before I went there.
Yeah.
And many other celebrities, but mixed up with those are, just real hardcore drug addicts who, have had a hard way. So anyway, they took me in, and they, they changed my life. They changed my life. They taught me some skills and some tools and put me back together. I can't thank those people enough. They took the time. I was there almost a year.
Right.
It took that much time to put me back together. I'm forever grateful.
That's unbelievable, because a lot of people go in and a lot of people come out and, they don't heal. I mean, you have to really, from my way of thinking, you really have to have it inside of you. I think the bottom line is it has to come from within you, no matter what they're doing, outside of you. Showing you the right way and giving you the right diet and giving you the right things to think about. I guess it has to come from deep down inside of you.
Yeah, but you have to get your head, has to be given the time to clear, and so you can even make a rational thought, because there is a great period of time in addiction when you have no choice, because you're so addicted,
right,
that you just there's no way you can just turn it off. You're insane, you've broken your brain. And they gave me that time to heal, and then their guides, and then they instilled in me that this is something that I needed. I needed to want more than anything.
Right. No, I hear you. I mean, I can remember back in the days when I was doing a lot of recording in New York, and, people just don't know. I mean, I watched New York Yankees that you would look at me and say, nah, you're kidding me. I watched them go in and buy Coke from the music people. I watched a couple of New York Mets. I watched, and I said, what are they doing here? They're coming to record an album. They said, nah, they buy their Coke from the music people. That's the best Coke. I mean, and I would laugh, and I would say, this is the real world. This is the real world. I mean, it's there.
Scary.
It's there if
Scary.
You want it, especially when you reach that level and you're on the road all the time and people are expecting big things from you every time you go out there. It's a lot of pressure, I guess, It's tough.
Well, you know, sometimes, you know, people are just partying, and
right.
and the next thing you know, before they know it, they got a habit, you know, and, you know, but yeah, if you're a baseball player, you're going to a studio copying drugs. You're on the wrong road.
Well, let me tell you, I saw it, you know, and I rubbed my eyeballs and I said, it was almost as profound as when we did the White House and I watched Bill and Hillary argue with each other and Katie Couric turn off the cameras. It was like 3 weeks after the blue dressing incident. And I said, am I really seeing this? And I said, yeah, real life. Here we go again. You know, tough stuff. What's your favorite Three Dog Night tune?
You know, they change. I mean, it's different. A lot of for different reasons. You know,
right.
I love Out in the Country,
right?
Because it showed that we could do anything,
right?
I mean, you know, I mean, to have all those chops and all that ability, but yet come and do such a laid-back, sensitive song. You know, I don't know if there's any band out there that could do A Mama Told Me Not to Come and an Out in the Country.
Right. No, I hear you.
Want some whiskey in your water, sugar in your tea? What's all these crazy questions they're asking me? This is the craziest party that could ever be. Cause I don't wanna see. Mama told me not to come. Mama told me not to come. That ain't the way that I'm about to go. Open up your window, let some air into this room. I think I'm almost choking from the smell of stale perfume. And that cigarette you're smoking, I'm scared of him to death. Open up the window, sucker. Let me catch my breath. Mama told me not to come. Mama told me not to come. That ain't the way that I find sun. That ain't the way that I find
sun. Oh, yeah.
one take, and
right.
And it made me, when I heard the playback, I said, you know what, I'm pretty good, you know, first time I won, I think I can do this,
right?
You know, so,
right. Well, you know, I got to tell you from, you know, as a musician and a vocalist and also a fan, I mean, your vocals were like pearls, and you know, I could run through the list and everything else, but every one of them was, as you say, a home run. I used to laugh because, you know, we used to do black and white with a cover band that I had, and I used to love to play the chords to that tune because they go back and forth, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a fun tune to play and sing, believe it or not.
Yeah, but it was number one record, so.
Right. You know, but then again, you know, there were a lot of tunes that Three Dog Night did that cover bands didn't have the ability to touch because they couldn't play them.
Yeah, Eli's Coming wasn't easy.
No, absolutely not. Because, well, you know, if you're going to cop that, you know, the first 20 seconds of the tune, if you don't nail that, then why bother? And nobody's going to cop that unless they do. You know what I mean? It's like I said, you either do it or you don't, you know. It's unbelievable how that works.
Eli's coming. Eli's coming.
coming and the cards say,
a broken heart.
I thought to myself long and hard during the week, and I said to myself, you know, Chuck is out and back and better than ever now. And, you know, I wonder how much you go back in your mind and think about all those days with Three Dog Night. I guess forever and always you'll be part of Three Dog Night. I guess the group, whatever is left of it, is out doing their thing, as so many groups do. You know, they splinter and they do this and that. When I think of Three Dog Night, I think of Chuck Negron, you know, and the leads and whatever. I guess my question is, how much of Three Dog Night is still left in you, you know, when you get out there? How much in your mind have you transcended past that?
You know, it's, I think that just a process that happens over time,
right,
when the process of morphing into a solo singer as opposed to someone who sings with two other singers,
right,
because there's a definite sensibility and power, and it's just things you can't do just because you have the ability to do them, you know,
right,
what I mean?
Right,
you have to work within the parameters of your partners,
right.
And that was something, you know, that I learned and I was proud to do. You know, I was proud to, you know, to have the home run, have the home run back, but not have to use it.
I hear you.
But anyway, what did happen was I was very non-committal on the stage, and I realized that, you know, I'm not going to upstage anybody by moving. And so little by little, I really became a different performer, a different singer, because I was now a solo artist.
Gotcha.
And even though I was doing, the, you know, the Three Dog Night things.
Right.
And that was a wonderful thing, to be able to carry a show, to be able to talk to the audience.
Right. And step out of character, it's, you know, of the pre-planned Three Dog Night show.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Because my character, since I sang so much,
right,
in Three Dog Night, I never said a word.
Right.
Yeah, we let Danny and Corey said words, because Danny sang the lead, so we let him talk and
right,
introduce. So, and my thing was just stand there and look good, you know, and of course sing.
Right.
So, so this is a very new, fun thing, and the thing about, you know, being on stage, you're learning, you know, you can learn every show.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of growth and learning still going on.
Oh, sure. You develop as a performer, you know, when you're out, it's because, you know, when you're out there with other guys, you know, there's a lot to look at. When it's only you, every little inflection, if you scratch your chin or whatever, it's everything is like being under a microscope at that point. You know, it's all on you.
Yeah.
It's got to be scarier.
Yeah, it's just kind of fun. It's not scary. It's just fun because I'm kind of running the show and I just have to be prudent.
Right.
You know, to not go over the top. You know?
No, I hear you. So I guess there were a bunch of years that you were not vocalizing.
Well, that's...
Or were you singing during those days as well, even around...
No, I did things here and there.
Right.
I did some sessions.
Right.
I did some record things, and actually were pretty good, but my reputation kind of killed all the deals. But anyway,
how were your chops at that time?
They were good. I went on a tour. I was very surprised because I went on a tour called the 30th Anniversary of Rock and Roll, and that was in 1988, 1989, and 1990.
Right.
30th Anniversary. And I was frail, still using drugs, but my voice was there.
Wow.
My voice was there.
Very cool.
I wasn't as strong, you know, as I would have liked to have been, because I went in the cryo in 91, and that's when my life turned around. So those last 3 years before I went into cryo, you know, I was singing the entire summer, these tours.
Right.
Yeah, so at that point I was vocalizing.
Wow, that's great. I heard you say, either on a TV show or on an interview one time, you got to keep getting better. I thought about it myself because, you know, I haven't sung in a while, and then I was getting back to singing, and I'm doing some shows down here in Florida and everything else, and, you know, and it kind of hit me, and I said, you know, okay, I'm 67, you know, I keep going back to this, and I've had limited success, and, you know, this and that, but once it's in you, you got to keep singing. And then I heard you say that, and I said, you know what, I'm going to start doing my vocal exercises again because I got to keep getting better. So
yeah, and you know, it's good, but there is a time. There's a time, I think, in every musician's life that just because of physical limitations,
to the phase,
that the pendulum swings,
right?
And you know, it's going down, so you've gotta work at it just to keep it up.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean? Because I'm doing that now because I'm still doing the songs in the same keys.
Wow.
And last summer was hard. My voice got tired.
Right.
But then again, I did 63 shows.
Wow.
Yeah, we went out and did 63 shows in this one tour.
Right. I got to tell you something. It just popped into my mind. I know it's out of sequence or whatever, but I worked with a kid by the name of Steve Adorno. And Steve Adorno, we had a disco group called Devotion, and we did some of that. But he was the drummer for a group called GQ from the Bronx, and they had a couple of R&B hits. They did I Do Love You and a couple other things. And, you know, being that you were from a Puerto Rican father, Steve Adorno used to say to me all the time, there's no such thing as chili con carne, man. It's chili con carne. And don't you forget it.
Oh, that's funny.
That just popped into my head because he always said that to me. He says, what? With chili con carne, there's no such thing. You know, that was my lesson. Well, actually, believe it or not, when I was the dean at Castle Hill, you know, we had a lot of Spanish kids, and it used to bother me that they taught these kids in Spanish, bilingual, and so by the time these kids got out of the 12th grade, they still couldn't speak English because they were being taught in Spanish. And I would
that
say,
makes no sense.
Why are you doing this to these kids? The Asian kids have to learn the language in 2 weeks and speak.
Yeah.
The Albanian kids, the Italian kids that came into this country, they had to learn the language. But you're teaching the Puerto Rican, the Dominican, the Cuban kids, the Mexican kids all in Spanish. And what happened was, here it is, 12th grade, they still hardly spoke English. I said, you know,
I wonder why they chose to do that.
I don't know. I think it's because it's the same concept. It's the same concept that you get when you pick up the phone and they go English or Spanish. I mean, you know, because of the large influx, you know, of Hispanic-speaking kids. Some of the people that that you listened to when you were a young guy, I understand you listened to Jackie Wilson a lot.
I listened to him. You know, I liked the Drifters. I liked what the Drifters were doing. Well, with different lead singers.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, basically what's funny is the Drifters had this fight as to who were the original Drifters and who weren't. And, you know, Treadwell owned the Drifters' name, and none of those people that sang for the Drifters, not Charlie Thomas and not Benny King and not any of them, really owned the name. So they were all fighting with each other just for, like, you know, King of the Hill rights.
Oh,
know?
Really?
Oh, yeah, because George Treadwell owned the name, and those guys were all on salary, believe it or not. That's the true story.
Wow.
Is there anything that you would like to talk about that we haven't hit on that you might like a whole bunch of people to know?
Well, I'm in a studio now, and I'm doing my sixth solo album.
Wow.
Called Then and Now.
Mm-hmm.
And it has three Dog Night songs that never were released.
Wow.
And they're good. And then they have the newest stuff that I've written and I'm doing. So there's... a bunch of great stuff on. So we're in the studio now. I'm going back in tomorrow.
Wow.
And putting some B3 on, actually.
Wow, that's pretty impressive, you know. As I say, I've always been a Three Dog Night fan and a Chuck fan. And, you know, to me, just having the time to sit and talk with you is a thrill. What would you like to say to fans of yours who have followed you all through Three Dog Night and continue to follow you and are glad that you're back and doing better than ever? What would you say to those people?
I want to thank you all, especially the ones that have prayed for me and the people that support me and have supported me. I can't tell you how much it means to me, and I'm still going. Thank you.
That's fabulous. When are you coming to Florida?
You know what? I'll be there with the Happy Together tour, but I'm not sure when.
Ah, you're doing Happy Together. I know Mary.
Yeah.
I talk to Mary Wilson all the time. She calls me. She's a good buddy. And, you know, I know she's in and out of that tour. And let's see. Gary Lewis, I think, is on that tour. And Flo
Lewis,
and Eddie.
Mark Farner. Mitch Ryder.
Right.
Me and Flo and Eddie.
Wow. You know, I did New Year's. I sang with the Mystics for many, many years down here in Florida, you know, the Hushabye guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we did, you know, I was singing with them for a while when I moved to Florida. And we did New Year's with Gary Lewis this got to be about 6 or 8 years ago. And I walked up behind him. I put my hands on my shoulder and I said, Gary Levitch. And he turns around and he says to me, nobody's called me that in 50 years because, you know, Jerry Lewis's real name was Levitch.
And, not really.
And when I used to sing in the Catskills years ago, Danny Levitch was the grandfather and he was at the Windsor Hotel and he used to walk around greeting people and he was the MC and all of that, you know. So I remember the name being Levitch originally.
Oh, wow.
You know, and there you go, Gary Levitch. You know what I mean? So it's all good. So... I'm going to certainly catch you during the Happy Days tour. I'm going to make arrangements for that, you know, and then this way I can close up and
yeah,
in person.
I'd love to see you.
Close up and in person, just like congratulate you for like coming back stronger than ever. And I'm real proud of you for that. It's just a fabulous thing, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, man, you take care.
Hey, Chuck, I really appreciate this.
Thank you, man. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Ciao.
I dream she's the one that I adore. I would be so happy if she'd be mine forevermore. Just for one single minute out of life's eternity, I'd tell her of my true love, then kiss her tenderly. She's an angel from heaven, a dream girl with all her charms. Oh, oh, how I long for to hold her in my arms. Just for one single minute out of life's eternity, I'd tell her of my true love, then kiss her tenderly. Ah, I dream of an angel. Hope my dreams come true. It's all that I long for, 'cause that angel I dream of is you.
And you're listening to my good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
It was a silent night when the Savior was born. It was a silent night.
Tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep in heavenly peace. Christ the Savior.
thy birth. Well, I never been to Spain, but I kinda like the music. See, the ladies are insane there, and they sure know how to use it. They don't abuse it, never gonna lose it. I can't refuse it. Well, I never been to England, but I kinda like the Beatles. Well, I hit it for Las Vegas, only made it out to Needles. So good, well, feel so good. Well, I never been to heaven, but I've been to Oklahoma. Well, they tell me I was born there, but I really don't remember.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. right now. Too tired to try. Thank you.
money, but boy, if I did, I'd build a big house where we both could live. If I were a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. It's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's gone, I hope you don't mind.
Harmony. Harmony Street. Yes, there were times when we had it all figured out. Then there were times when we both had our doubts. But through it all, you know, our love was complete. We spent all our time on Harmony Street. ¶¶